So welcome to This Cycling Life. Today we're delighted to be joined by Adam Hansen. I don't think Adam needs too much of an introduction. He turned professional in 2007 and has had a stellar career. He's been a national champion, and in a moment you'll see his national jersey hanging on the wall behind him, but also he's been multiple Grand Tour stage winner, and of course he holds the record, in fact the historical record, of completing the highest number of consecutive Grand Tours in history with a total of 20 tours completed. But of course, in addition to his life as a professional cyclist, Adam has also been an entrepreneur, an inventor, and an investor. So what we're going to be talking today is very much more than life in the peloton. We're going to be talking about life beyond the peloton.
Hey, Adam, great to have you on the show. And maybe I can start with the first question. Now that you're retired from cycling, can you give us a quick heads up or update on how it is going in your retirement? How are you spending your days nowadays?
Going actually very good. I'm very much enjoying retirement. But basically, my days are pretty much the same. So nothing's really changed, apart from I'm not riding as much as I did before. I love to keep myself busy and just the usual little things that I was doing before, but without the bike riding.
Go ahead, Bernard.
Now there is plenty time more, so to speak. How do you fill that up? Is that just doing more of what you were already doing besides riding your bike?
Yeah, so I've been working for a company called Limo, which does motion analysts, and I've been working for them for 2 years and 2 months. So this is also like a part-time job as I was riding for a lot of Sadal. So this is always continued. Doing a lot of Zoom calls. Last night I did one at 1 a.m. Also another one at 12 a.m. So it's good scattered because we have an American office and a Japanese office too. But this job is more for, I actually really enjoy it. It's more for fun and motion analyzing and that. So this is sort of made constant. I have a little projects on the side that I'm always doing. So one of the things is I sell altitude tents. I've been doing this quite a lot also. So I've been stocking up on converting machines to do altitude training. Other things I do is, I do a lot with property investment in the Czech Republic. This hasn't really, none of the things I'm doing is really increased in the amount of time because I've got more free time. I've been focusing more on other projects that I'm trying to start up that I've never had the time before to do now. So this has been a really good opportunity in that sense. So for example, I've made like carbon fiber shoes, as some of you probably know, and I'm reaching out into other carbon fiber products for cycling. There's definitely a market for, custom handlebars or TT bars. You see a lot of guys that are getting onto them. So, I have like all equipment here with the 3D scanner and 3D printer. And so what I'm doing now is trying to develop a package where you can send out to a rider and they can adjust their own system and come and back, and then I make it out of carbon fiber. So it's more like a modular system with the 3D printer. This is something that's not on the market. I think that could be really useful because at the moment they do a lot of molds and it's really, you got one shot to do it and you have to come to their location where I want to send a package and they can do it in their time with their bike fitter and things like that. And they send me the modular piece back and then I make it from carbon fiber in more aerodynamic form. So I'm recommending.
I didn't quite get the first job that you were doing with the Zoom calls and the international component. What is that involved?
I work for a company called Limo. And they have motion sensors where you place on your body. And so it's more data analysis of the motion of the ride and also runners too. And this is using gyro and accelerometers in the sensors. And basically I'm in the research and development of working out what motion is the best for cyclists. I'm also a test person for the running side. I don't do much on the running side, but more the cycling side. And then we analyze the motion data and find out, when a rider is performing good power, if he's more motion in the fluid of his downstroke. and also via his dead spot scores, if we can maximize his leg angle ranges for better power output and see if his pelvic is stable on the bike. There's too much movement when you're flying power. That comes back. So this is a lot of things I do for them. And also, I do a lot of communications when we do sponsoring teams, for example, or introducing new employees. I do a lot of the research and development on the motion analyzing and also introducing the product to, future partners and things like that.
So I guess this relates back to, because as we understand it, I mean, you, before becoming a professional cyclist, you were working in the world of software. And I think you mentioned, you've been working in the banking sector and real estate. So it seems that you came into life as a pro cyclist already with quite a bunch of skills related to technology, software, even the area of real estate we were investing there in the Czech Republic. And then in many ways, you kind of just continued using those skills beside what you were doing as a pro cyclist. Would that be kind of a fair analysis of how you looked at your pro career? Because it seemed to us, looking at your pro career, that it was almost like a portfolio. You know, you had your cycling, you had your training, you had your nutrition and all the other stuff you were looking after. But beside that, you still had this portfolio of activities that you continued doing?
Oh, for sure. I was brought up in a family where you can never make money from sport. So and I always had this in my head, cycling was good, it was fun, yes, I was making income from it, but I always wanted something on the side. You could break your leg really badly in a crash and that's it, it's all over. So I always had something on the side. And even, during my off season, I was doing these intense courses in London, for example, where you do like 2 weeks of intensive courses, like at the Learning Tree. And this is actually worth points at university. Which is, for me, it was really good because you can switch off in the off season, you can do some education. And then when you sort of stop, you're sort of more inclined to ride more because, you're not just riding. So it's good of, a switch in that sense to, switch your brain from riding to something else. Definitely. I always had something on the side. And I always believed you should, because your life is very, very long. Your cycling career is very, very short. So for me, it was always, I always think long-term and, I definitely do not want to put all my eggs in one basket, like as an investor.
That's certainly something that our friend Bernard Mordemann, who's on this call, has said before. Bernard used to tell his young guys at the cycling center that you're only one crash away from a job at McDonald's.
Exactly.
So related to that, I guess then the question becomes, Adam, because you know Bernard and I, we've interviewed so many current and former professional cyclists, and we often hear from these pros that say, well, I shouldn't be thinking about other things beside my pro career because that's going to kind of detract from my performance, my focus, my energy channeling into my sport. I mean, what do you see as the biggest blockers, imagined or otherwise, for pros to actually invest in developing themselves and preparing themselves for a life after pro sport?
I think, everything that's wrong, well, not wrong, but that's that could be regarded as wrong in cycling is tradition. And, traditionally it wasn't like this. And that, that's with everything in cycling. If Enos and Sky was the first team sort of break out of the mold of not doing traditional things with training and, just different innovations. And that's also the same, like a lot of riders, I think they have fear to do something different because it wasn't done in the past. And there's no reason why you cannot. Cyclists actually have a lot of free time on their hands. They train a lot less than what people work full time. There's a lot of time they can spend, sitting on the couch and having the legs up with a PC in front of them. They don't have to be watching Netflix. They don't have to be playing computer games on the PlayStation, things like that. They can actually be investing into the future.
Are you saying that becoming skillful at PlayStation is not a career-enhancing skill? Is that what you're saying?
Well, if you want to be a game tester, there is a path down there. But, for me, in one sense, I was more relaxed knowing I had a very good passive income coming in and I could focus more on my sport. And that's how I looked at it, where if I was just earning money in sport, then it's more like I'd probably be more worried and concerned about the future afterwards. But if I had a good passive income, then I could more relax into the sport.
But can you just explain that, Adam? Can you explain that to people? Because I think not everybody would appreciate what passive income actually means.
Okay, so you got basically two sources of income. You can use your time to earn money, and time is limited. So, you know, if you're earning, let's say, a thousand euro and you're giving 40 hours a week, you can't increase 1,000 euro to 2,000 because you only got the 40 hours a week. You can't double it to 80. Okay, some people can, but you know, and then, but if you only got 3,000, you can't do only 20 hours. And passive income is an income that you're basically doing passively, you're doing nothing. So I'm sitting here right now and I've got rentals making property for me right now. And that's a source of passive income. Or you can have shares, for example, and make profit on dividends for like that. And you're making money doing absolutely nothing. You have to invest time at the start, but then you have the long-term benefits afterwards. So yeah, passive income is the best way to make money.
So I guess another piece of advice there, because of course a lot of neo pros, the first investment they make is in a very expensive luxury car. However, that is involving depreciation, which is kind of the opposite of what you're talking about, right? So aren't you also talking here a little bit about delayed gratification? I mean, not just spending the money that you're earning, but, you know, to buy the nice car, the watch, the nice house, but thinking about that in a different way. I mean, what's your experience looking at neo pros and when they do start making real money, what have you witnessed?
Well, definitely, yeah, exactly what you said. I always say that it's more important saving the money. So exactly what you're saying, if you're spending on cars, watches, or expensive rental properties for yourself. So if one guy is making 100,000 euro per year, another guy is making 60,000 per year, but the guy that's making 100,000 per year is spending 70,000 and he's saving 30, then the guy making 60 is actually saving 40,000. Then he's actually going to have a better career afterwards, where he can invest that money somewhere else for a passive income. So it's not, to me, it's not how much money you make, it's how much money you save and how smart you are with that money. So in this sense, yeah, you know, you can be making almost nothing, but if you're investing a lot and you're saving a lot, then you're going to be far beneficial long-term than someone who's making a lot. And I understand that, you know, neo pros and even older riders where they have a dream car or dream watch or something like that. And, you know, that they buy these expensive the cars and they do lose a lot. Like as soon as you drive, you know, I'm probably a bad example. I do have some nice cars. But, you know, for me, it was more like, okay, I've got to have a passive income that I can live off first. I've got to, you know, there's some people that do like the percentage where they say, okay, 10% of your incomes you can invest into luxury things and the other, and then so 40% into investments or something like that. You know, there's different ways you can go around it, but definitely first, when I see a neo pro, first thing they buy is an expensive car, I definitely think this is, not the best and smartest decision. And also the worst thing is when these type of people buy these type of cars, they can't really afford the special editions. And because of that, the special editions, okay, you can make money on these ones, but they cost, you know, two times or three times more. And they buy the ones that as soon as you drive it out of the garage, you've lost like 20, 30% just like that. And that's a bit of a shame.
That's a lot of lessons in 5 minutes, Adam. I mean, this is what I was preaching for 25 years. And Do you agree with the fact that it has to do with why you're doing what you're doing? At least for me, when I hear you talk, your why has been way further than just being a cyclist. If I'm wrong, just tell me. So Since you were aware of your why, you were approaching it way more, you know, well, how should I say, way more adult, so to speak, so that it's great to achieve big things in cycling, but it's not the end. Do you understand what I'm saying? Where I have worked with so many guys that came from Australia, from South Africa, from America, and my first question was, why are you here? And because I want to become a pro cyclist. Well, you know, and I think this is a very narrow-minded answer. Do you see it that way, or do you see other common challenges or struggles? A lot of guys want to become cyclists or come over from other countries? Because what you're doing is to me a perfect example of how it should be done. And you would, I live in Belgium, so talking about tradition. So if in Belgium you say to a cyclist that he has way more time than anybody else to relax, and while he's relaxing, he can just learn things. Because I was always joking with the guys, they were looking at cycling news or you know, those websites, and like an hour later they were still doing the same thing, where I was like, did anything change? No. Well, why are you continue to do that? Just learn another language, or you know. So do you see other common struggles of mainly young riders that have no idea to spend their time workfully towards later?
Yeah. What I see is a lot that, you know, the worst thing about a cyclist is they get given everything for free, directly from the start, directly from a young age. You know, they'd be like, even from the age of 14, you know, parents buy them a bike and then they put into the national program and they get free jerseys, free equipment, and they get to travel and they get free travel. When you're away, you get free food. And life is not so easy in the real world. This is a good struggle in a sense, you know, where everything is provided. And I understand that. I do understand it. And the problem with a lot of these athletes is they go into continental teams or pro-continental teams, and it's continuing. You still get free bike. And this goes back to what I say. It's not how much money you make. It's how much money you save. And by getting a free bike and free kit and free helmet, free glasses, free shoes, and you go to a race in a different country and you don't have to pay for that trip, you know, just the bike and equipment and, you know, paying for the races, you're looking at almost 20,000 euro. That you don't have to spend, that you get given for free. So as soon as you exit the cycling and you have just these costs, you know, this is a big eye opener. And probably so for me, my advantage that I had is that I worked before I was a cyclist. So I knew what the real world was. I worked at McDonald's. I used to deliver papers. I used to work on farms and picking up sticks and things like that. And I was a programmer for 4 years. And I knew that, for me, it was like, okay, cycling is fun, and I enjoy it, and I love it, and I always called it my hobby, and I knew what was coming around the corner. And so for me, it was more like, okay, let's make sure that when I retire from cycling, I just can put my feet up and never do a single thing ever again. But I became addicted to work, so I actually really enjoy it, and that's probably one of the special things that you have to do, really pick something you enjoy doing.
This is also interesting what you say, Adam, because I guess one of the things that struck us is, and not just the top level cyclists who get national or international podiums, but this sense of entitlement that you talk about seems to also have another effect sometimes, which is for many of these young riders, particularly riders with talent, and even guys who then get into their 30s, the doors are always opening in front of them, right? Because if you have talent, people are after you. You know, they're offering you the next step. They're promoting you either within the team. And one of the things we've sensed is that for many professionals, they seem to believe that when their career happens, that their career comes to an end, their competitive career, that's going to continue, that these opportunities will sort of fall out of the sky. Would you agree with that, disagree with that? What have you witnessed with people?
Yeah, you're right. You know, everyone's your friend when you're a winner. And it's, you can, you know, cyclists, they should remind themselves when they have a bad season, contract year comes up, it's like, wow, it's not so easy to get a contract, you know. And these little lessons actually, you know, this is not so magnified, but it is magnified when you retire. It's true, you do get opportunities when you retire, that is true, but don't think that this is going to happen, you know, 1, 2, 3 years, because you will get forgotten so quickly, and you shouldn't rely on this. You should not rely on your name. That's just my personal opinion. I think you should take advantage of it if you can. Cool, go for it, take advantage of it, but don't sit there thinking that all these opportunities are definitely going to come up in the future.
That's all right. So would you have some sort of a solution, or how would you think you could help changing that mentality? Because don't tell me. I came across those situations 25 years in a row, you know, where they thought, oh, we won a race, so for now we're clear, we will have a next contract, and later we will we'll still be helped in life. So would there be ways, you think, that we can help riders early on to realize that what you're saying, that is not the real world? The real world is about really achieve things continuously.
Well, you know, exactly what you guys are doing. It's education. It's just a form of educating the riders. I believe I had a good impact in a lot of saddle riders, where riders would look at me and they knew I wasn't earning so much. And they would look at me and go, okay, Adam doesn't make so much, but he has a pretty good lifestyle. He does have some flash cars. He is focusing on other things outside of cycling. And I could see that some riders, and like I actually had a good influence where I made other riders, not force, but, you know, they looked at me and they said, hey, Adam's investing in property. Maybe we should also have a look into it. And I'd have people, you know, quiz me, ask me. I had some riders that actually went to university because of me, where they, you know, I remember one particular rider, Sven, he was sort of like, he said, so you actually studied also? I said, yeah. Then, and I remember when he was a first year, and then I said, well, when do you have time? I said, well, we have heaps of time, you know, after training and during races and travel days and that. And then he actually went to university. 2 years later, he goes, you know, you're right. I had no idea how much free time I had until I actually, you know, did university parallel to cycling. Because we do get lost on that thing where, you know, as you said, you're checking the news and you're checking again and you're checking again and nothing changes. And you can check the news directly after training ride, or you check it directly before you're going to bed. You still get it all before you go to bed, you know. Yeah. And maybe you might be 2 hours delayed or 3 hours delayed, but, you know, it's not going to change anything.
It's interesting that because what we're talking about here is the difference between sort of intrinsic factors, right, which is my motivation, my desire, you know, my what I guess Bernard was alluding to, my purpose, which is, what is my purpose beyond being a cyclist? You know, maybe my purpose is to acquire new knowledge, new skills, to build myself sustainable income, to support others, whatever it might be. However, one of the things we've also heard in conversations is that, in terms of this tradition that you talked about, that in some teams, if you're seen to be distracted with other work or hobbies or interests away from the bike, then some people say that they feel self-conscious about that, that maybe the DSs or the coaches, they're looking at you as not being 100% committed. We even had a conversation with a recently retired Australian, another recently retired Australian, who said, no, I was very conscious towards the end of my career even talking about retirement, because I thought there's other guys ready to step into my shoes, that, you know, maybe they were doubting my commitment. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I definitely felt that. But having said that, you know, you don't have to have a job where you have to, you know, go to and wear a uniform and your team finds out about it. You know, like, let's say you're investing, you know, into property, for example, you know, in 3 hours, you can go out with a real estate agent and you can see, not in 2 hours, you can go out to the real estate agency and basically see three properties or four properties. And then, you know, that's just 2 hours on 1 week. And then you can think about it. And then you go to, if you can't afford it, you can go to a bank and get a partial loan. So you can pay like 50% deposit. And then going to a bank is like a 1 hour exercise, you know, and you can do that the week after. And then you can just do the math. It's not so complicated. Or you can speak to your accountant. That's another hour exercise. And then if you finally do it, it's maximum 2 hours after that. And then you've actually got, if you pay 50% of the property and you got a good mortgage, and today's time interest rates are so low, which is really good, you actually got a very small passive income for basically doing 6 hours of work spread out over 1 month, which is doable. And the sports director does not need to know anything about it. He won't even know the difference. And there are a lot of riders that are actually doing some things like this. So, you know, you don't have to, I understand that teams are a bit like this, and this is understandable. You know, teams are paying you money to perform at your best, and they just want they just want robots. That's what they really want. They want people that riders that do 100% what they say and everything that they don't think they should do. But you know, it's, I don't believe 6 hours of your time over a month is going to distract you from cycling. And maybe I think a lot of people do need a distraction from cycling. You know, I think that can help on a positive side also.
Yeah, because isn't that like, if you want to have a top performance, I think it also is necessary that the rider has a time to really relax, at least to not think about the bike and not think about the next coming race, isn't it? Or, you know, I don't think you can be focused 24/7 all year long. So why would you not try to find something where you really can dive in so that you defocus on your riding for some moments? Obviously you need discipline, but, and that's, to me, that's a big contradiction, because every coach, every DS wants you to be ready to go. But don't you think you can only be ready to go if there was a moment of defocus before?
Oh, 100% agree with you on that. I think you can get too much into something. Yeah. And it's nice to step it away. Like even like with my training, for example, you know, during the off season, I'd make sure I'd never ride the bike in November. I'd be doing other training forms, right? And even for half of December, I wouldn't ride my bike either. I'd be doing like cross training, cross country skiing, hiking the mountains, things like that. So when I came to training camp, I was the most motivated rider there to ride my bike, because there are riders that are in Belgium, you know, doing 4 weeks of riding before in the rain, bad weather and things like that. And they get to training camp, they've just done heaps of riding. They're already sick of the bike in a sense. And they get to training camp, like, you know, it's the same thing. For me, it's like, whoa, I get to ride my bike. I'm excited. And you do heaps of training. And for me, I see the, how I take it, it's the same thing. You know, when you switch off a little, you know, when you finish the training camps or finish your racing and you're doing other things, when you go back to your cycling mode, you're actually more enthused to do it because you're more hungry to do it. So I definitely agree that you should have some time off and do things outside of cycling. Just to appreciate it more. You know, you get that fire and hunger, and it's not just 100%, you know, cycling, 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 cycling.
But coming to that as well, Adam, I think it's an interesting one related to, again, it's a bigger picture, which is as an individual, people taking the time to really reflect upon, you know, what their talents are, you know, like, because I think a lot of the conversations we've had, and, you know, I mean, Mick Rogers, he's a great, great, great friend of ours. And, you know, Mick's a really interesting guy because, of course, you know, he went through his career and he was three-time world time trial champion. And he was really a technical expert, you know, when it came to aerodynamics and training and all of those aspects. So, however, he always had a background kind of in technology, you know, as well. He was always interested in computers and that kind of stuff. However, you know, Mick finished his career and he went off and did a few things, but he eventually found himself back in that role of performance director with NTT team, doing what he did as a cyclist, more or less, you know, in terms of really bringing in his expertise. However, he started to realize that that was not really what he was passionate about, or maybe not even where his true talents lie, because actually what we started to discover with Mick is that, you know, he's an incredible leader. You know, he's a visionary in terms of thinking the way that the sport could be evolving. He is actually very knowledgeable and has learned a lot about technology, you know, virtual platforms and the way that's evolving. And eventually what Mick started to discover was actually that maybe he was doing the wrong thing, you know, as a performance director. And eventually what that led him into was this whole exploration of a new role with the UCI. And he's now manager of innovation at the UCI. So, I mean, it's a long kind of comment question, but to what extent do you think that a lot of pros and former pros get it wrong? Because what we see is many retire and they go straight into or back into the skills mode, right? So they open a bike shop or they start coaching or doing bike fit or whatever it might be. They rush into that within literally weeks or even, you know, maybe months of retiring. But then within 18 months, 2 years, they're dissatisfied. They're not enjoying it. So what do you think riders might do differently in that latter stages of their career not to make those kind of mistakes, you know, jumping into areas where maybe it's not the right place for them to be?
Yeah, you know, it's a bit of a lottery, but you got to do something you're passionate about, and you got to take a step back and think, okay, do I really want to do this? And is this going to really work? I had one friend during my career, and he always wanted to have a restaurant, That was his dream, passion, and that. And, he said, and I'm not a huge fan into the the restaurant business. But, you know, it's a lot of work, a lot of hours, and you're working with employees that rock up and don't turn up to work. And I always try and stay away from employees, because the more employees you have, the more problems you have. But this is just my way of thinking. But anyway, long story short, he started the restaurant, and he was thinking about it. I said, you know, you should do it now in your career if you can do it, because if it doesn't work, then you still have the financial income in your cycling, you know, to support your plan B or plan C, in a sense, where if you just finish cycling, you put all your money that you invested in from cycling into it, and then it doesn't work, then actually you've just retired and spent all your savings, and then, okay, you're really on the back burner.
Which, by the way, is a very common problem. I mean, we're talking to some guys in the US who actually are in the business of really providing financial support and advice to pro athletes, not just cyclists. Adam, you won't believe it. You know, these guys say that up to 50% of former professional athletes are bankrupt within 5 years of retirement. Yeah. For the reason you said, actually, they jump into a business that maybe they're not fully skilled in or knowledgeable about. They bring in this kind of winner's entitlement mentality, and they go bust within 3 to 5 years. So what you're saying makes a lot of sense. You know, try it before you retire. You know, have this portfolio of activities, experiments before you retire, and avoid that risk. You know, what might be some of the other, you might say, common mistakes or that you've seen riders doing upon retirement?
Just having no plan. I think that's the biggest one. Just, yeah, like, yeah, for example, I don't want to say names, but we had the coronavirus period this year, obviously, and, you know, and this one rider I was speaking to, he was like, yeah, what are you going to do, blah, blah, blah. And then I said, well, and you guys, yeah, I'm thinking about retirement. And I said, oh, yeah, so what are you going to do? And he goes, I haven't worked it out yet. I said, look, right now we've got lockdown, we've got no races. Basically, okay, your team had a pay cut, you're still making your money. Your retirement starts now, like really now. And that was, this was in March, end of March. And I'll see, you're getting an income now and you've got 9 months of money coming in where you can actually physically start something. Don't wait until the end of the year where you've got no money coming in. Do it right now, and you're basically getting paid from your team to start your new future. It's perfect. Everybody would love this, you know what I mean? Because people don't have this luxury. And yep. I think just people start way too late. And and then also with this rider, I said, look, you don't have to retire this year. If you want to continue the year after, do that. But at least you've just got 9 months of income coming in to settling up. And then you can make the decision afterward. Because if you wait until the end of the year, make the decision then, you've just lost 9 months of your startup.
And you're absolutely right on that, because again, I mean, the research here, and not just in cycling, but across pro sports, the reality is that most professional athletes do not end their career on their terms, right? Yeah. It's not when they expect it. Most expect that they've got another year, another 2 years, even another 3 years, and then it happens. So I think, you know, what you're saying makes an incredible amount of sense. But again, we come back to this question. Why aren't they doing it? And I think that's the million-dollar question, right? And you know, we spoke recently with Matt Heyman says, Jamie, they're in denial. They just don't want the dream to end.
No.
Is it that simple that they're in denial? And again, what could the teams be doing? What could the CPA or the UCI, what could we be doing differently? Because actually, we're not just talking about this as being trivial. You know, for many of these riders, because they don't have a plan, because they don't have a direction, the outcome of that is often depression, you know, mental illness. You know, this is quite a serious issue, right? So I don't know. I mean, Bernard, I mean, what do you think? What do you think we could be doing different? Because Bernard, you tried to do it at the cycling center. You tried to prepare these guys for later life. Do you think, Bernard, that there's a role for the UCI or the CPA or the teams?
Well, Everybody should be involved in helping the people when they say we're going to help to build your career. That should also involve helping people to be ready for the career after their career. But I don't see that happening anywhere. Everybody is just focused on getting the sportive result. And I tried that, but... In the beginning, I got even laughed at, you know, you're not ambitious. You're not there to win races. I said, no, I want to make humans that are strong for life. And if they can become a cyclist, that's great. And if not, then not. But it's so amazing to hear Adam speak, because he is the seasoned rider that is saying exactly what I preached for 25 years. So they could say to me, well, you were not a pro rider, so how would you know? But here sits in front of us a seasoned rider that is exactly saying the same things. And yeah, it's unbelievable. I hope we people like Adam can help us, for the guys to realize that is the real life, not just, you know, pursuing a career for 10, 15 years when they have good luck. Let's face that too. As you said, one crash away.
Yeah, I mean, but that's interesting what you say there. You mentioned guys. Sorry. However, I've also witnessed something, Adam, and I'd be good to get your take on, Adam, you know, whose job is it, or should the teams or the UCI or the CPA have a stronger role? But the interesting thing I've also discovered, Adam, is the women cyclists that I've interviewed, the women pros, because in many ways the fact that their path is often more difficult, or the tenure of their careers is often not as long, in our experience, many of the women we've spoken to are much more prepared for this than the guys are, right? That's what we've seen. We've seen them studying on the side, having portfolio jobs on the side. So that's an interesting point. But let's come back, Adam. I mean, whose job is it? Should the teams have a role? Should the CPA have a role? Should the UCI have a role in educating people about this? These now, not just the transition from being a pro athlete to being, you know, a life after pro, but you also mentioned that transition, you know, from, you know, elite without contract to going into being, you know, maybe, you know, the under 23 pro into the, you know, world tour pro. There are also transitions where riders make mistakes, as you said, with regard to money, for example. So whose job is this?
Yeah, going back to your point, the first one is, yeah, definitely the reason is education. And yeah, there definitely needs to be better education for the riders. And when you spoke about the women's are far more switched on than the men. I dated a cyclist, and she was studying full-time, you know, really full-time as a cyclist. And you know, women do have a bit more time than a male, but not so much more. Women do race a little less, but not so much less. So, you know, there's no excuse why the males can't do it as much as the females. And you're 100% right. I've seen with the females that they actually do a really good job, because they know that they don't earn so much money, and they know it's not forever. And as you said, Matt Heyman, it's the riders are in denial, complete in denial about it. But who should do it? You know, like, if I was running a cycling team, I would like my riders to do it. But if I wanted to get every single drop from my employees, because that's what a rider is, an employee of the business, yeah, I would not be 100% in it. Which I understand, right? But that is wrong way of thinking, but that's just drawing 100% out of your assets, because a rider is an asset to their company. And so I understand that sense.
And by the way, Adam, that's how it happens in the business world as well.
Oh, 100%.
Now, if you're working for a McKinsey or a PwC Accenture, and then your boss finds out that you're also running a real estate business on the side, usually they're not overly delighted with that. I mean, that's the reality of the employer-employee contract, right?
Yeah, 100%, 100%. So, So, you know, it'll be hard to get the teams on board. And yeah, it's definitely something the CPA should look into. It's a, you know, there's so many problems in cycling, and that's the CPA's number one job, is, you know, to fix the problems in cycling. And this is one of the reasons why, okay, the UCI set this up, was the retirement fund, you know, because they're fully aware that the riders get just put out in the street by the teams, and like, you know, they've got something to start something with. But yeah, it's definitely a form of education. What you guys are doing right now is a form of putting it out there, and just making, you know, just having the riders be a little bit self-aware, because riders forget, they're a bit delusional, they're just focusing on racing, and they really believe they're going to get contracts until, you know, 60, which is just not reality. But yeah, it's definitely education, and maybe a external, like what you guys are doing, is, you know, this is perfect in a sense. It's just educating the riders and having little reality checks of the future.
Oh, great.
I have another question for you, Adam, more a personal question. The life you're having right now, when we now, for you, look forward, how would your life, how would you want to see your life being in 3 to 5 years from now? So what would be your evolution now? You're always been evaluating, but what is your future?
I'm actually pretty happy with my life now. I've had everything set up for my retirement. And for me, it wasn't like my cycling, it's probably not going to sound so good. My cycling wasn't, my whole life wasn't around cycling. So for me, it's not a huge thing that I'm retiring this year. You know, it's not like.
Hang on a second, mate. You did 20 grand tours in a row. How do you say your life was not around cycling when you do? But anyway, sorry, I don't want to interrupt you.
I've had this. I won't argue with that. So I had this because I always think of the future, And, I've had everything, little projects on the side and that. So for me retiring, nothing really changes. I just don't race professionally. I'm still going to do sport. But in the future, no, I'm pretty happy with how things are going. And I will focus more on real estate, that's for sure. And it's just a snowball effect. So it's been really good. And I'll continue in that. But at the moment, I don't need to, push or take risk or things like that. I'm well settled and I have a good passive income. And I just hope to focus more on enjoying the years that I missed out on being too focused on cycling.
Great. And that's terrific advice. And actually, I think and Bernard and I often talk about this as well, that I think what you're talking about here is the fact that the reason you are in the place that you are right now is that you've spent many years thinking about getting to this place, right? And the problem, of course, is for anyone who doesn't have a vision or a picture of where they want to be 3 to 5 years down the line, it's very unlikely they're going to get there because they don't know what it is, right? And I think what we're hearing from you is that this process of thinking about yourself as a person, what makes a good life for you, whether it's, relationships or the place you are or the kind of energy and passions that you're pursuing, because of course the other thing you haven't mentioned in this conversation is you're still pursuing your passion for sport in terms of going back to Ironman, which is wonderful, and yet you're doing all those things in terms of the place you're living, the opportunity to pursue this passion that you have for Ironman by having a portfolio of work that supports all of that, right? And I think this is ultimately what young or older professional riders need to understand, that ultimately thinking about this stuff is not frivolous. It's about actually creating that picture where ideally, as you've said, you can work a little or certainly work autonomously with some of these aspects like passive income. And that then allows you the freedom to live the life that you want to live, right? So it's very interesting.
Exactly. Just to interrupt you, Bernard, that question you asked me before with the 5 years, I actually thought of that 10 years ago. And I was doing exactly what you're asking 10 years ago. And that's probably should have had an incident. And that's why, Jamie, what you're talking about now is that's why I can go into a different sport. And I, I'm looking for some sponsors, but I get a sponsor opportunity. I'm like, I don't like that product. I don't need the money. I'm going to do exactly what I want, the exact bike I want to use, exact shoes I want to use, running shoes, or, and I can make these better choices now because I thought about that question around 5, 10 years ago. This is where I wanted to be, and I'm here now. And I didn't wait until, my cycling income stopped and I'm just left in the middle of nowhere. And I've made those choices. It's we should not be answering that question at the end of our career. We should be doing it well and truly before and setting that plan. Definitely.
Yeah, that's exactly why I asked the guys when they arrived, why are you doing this? Because I wanted to make him think already steps ahead, like what then, if that. No, perfect answer, thank you.
No, that's great. One of the things, Adam, my coach is Alan Davis, right? So I'm still competing as a master's athlete, and Alan is my coach. And, Alan always says to me, of course, particularly when you're preparing for a competition, And this relates to this whole aspect of how you channel your energy, right? So, of course, in cycling, what do we say? You know, don't stand when you can sit and don't sit when you can lie down, because you should be recovering, you could be recuperating. But I think what we've certainly heard from you is you can be lying down and you can be reading a book, you could be reflecting upon your future, you could be looking at some real estate. You know, you can be doing some other stuff while you're horizontal than looking at YouTube videos or, you know, playing on your PlayStation or whatever it might be. Not that you don't need that, because everybody needs fun and a bit of downtime. We appreciate that. However, as you've said, you know, professional athletes do have a lot of time on their hands, and a little bit of that could be channeled in. The other thing I think, just to reflect upon, Adam, is, you know, we all too often use this word retirement, you know, that I'm a retired pro cyclist. I mean, you're not a retired human being, right? I mean, you're just starting a new phase in your life. And I think that's also something which has struck Bernard and I in conversations we've had with pro cyclists, is that they fail to reflect upon the fact that the reality for pro cyclists is that retirement happens often before the middle of your life. You know, it's in your early 30s, maybe your mid 30s, and you still have 30 more productive years ahead of you. So, you know, the other thing sometimes we hear is people say, oh, I'm too old to go back to school. Now think about that for a moment. You know, I mean, look at, okay, Marcel Kittel, he finished his career. He decided that the pro cycling was not for him. He's gone back to university to do a degree. So this is also something that you know, we need to reflect upon, that life is long and that there's no reason you can't go back to school for 2 or 3 years, even in your early 40s, if you've built that financial stability and income to enable you to take that time out. I think that's the key we keep coming back to here.
Exactly.
Does that make sense, Adam?
Oh, 100%. I always have the same belief. Life is long. Life is very long. And yeah, you do retire at a young age. You know, that's probably one of the other things in cycling. Like, they think, you know, mid-30s is an old age. It's not an old age. Old for cycling, but there's, you know, people, depending on the country you're in, people retire at 60, 65, that age is going up. And there's a lot of years to put food and bread, you know, food on the table and put a roof over your head. And with the education thing, oh, 100% agree. My mother, she did a law degree in her mid-30s, and now she's the top prosecutor in Australia, Crown prosecutor, you know. And people think, no, you must finish school and do university directly after. So, no, you don't have to, you know. You don't have to. You can do it definitely after your cycling. But like I said, it's important what you do in racing during this period to build some financial support or some passive income, or, you know, to support the things you want to do after cycling. And that's the important key thing.
Yeah. And, of course, we've got another guy on this call. Another guy on this call who's an example of that, and that's Bernard. Because Bernard Mortemann gave his first TED talk about a month ago. Bernard is 62 years old. He's become a vlogger. He's become a tech guru. And he embarked on that journey about 18 months ago. So the idea that we're too old to start something new is, yeah, a little bit absurd perhaps. Yeah, but great. Any last words from you, Bernard?
Talking guru. It was a wonderful talk. And the only thing I would correct is, at your 35, you have more than 30 years left, huh? to be protective, at least I'm there. And I'm totally agreeing with what Adam said. I'm so pleased that what I've preached already for 25 years is now said by a guy that, you know, did 20 grand tours in a row and thinks cycling is not the main thing in his life, which is just a great thing to hear. I loved it, Adam. I think you're a role model, even more than you might even ever think you are. So for me, it was a great experience, this talk. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Adam. And of course, for those of you who've been watching this video, if you've liked it, please do give us the thumbs up. Of course, do share it with those who you think might benefit from the discussion. Of course, subscribe to the This Cycling Life YouTube channel. So, Adam Hansen, thanks again for this wonderful discussion.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.